Members, due to the similarity in the subject matter of Senate File 479 and Senate File 509, we'll hear the bills together today and Wednesday. We would like to get the bills before us in the form the authors want to present, and then give the authors time to present their bills. Then we'll open the floor to public testimony. We have a very lengthy list of testifiers, some of whom are not able to come back on Wednesday. We would like to hold amendments other than the author's amendments until Wednesday so that we can hear the public testimony. And we ask that if you are testifying, that you be brief as you can and to the point. We will be timing them, I think, to 3 minutes. So we'd appreciate your cooperation there. We want everyone to get a chance to speak. Senator Chamberlain moves House File 479 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Judiciary?
Senate File 479.
Be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on State Government, Innovation, and Veterans. Senator Howell, welcome to the committee and to your bill.
Mr. Chair and Senators, I thought we were going to start with Senator Limmer's bill.
Senator Howell, we can certainly do that. I'll also move that Senate File 509 be recommended to pass and be referred to the committee, the Judiciary Committee, Finance Committee. Senator Limmer, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, Senate File 509 is a bill that would change the way Minnesota identifies voters when voting and using a form of identification with a photo on it. The bill that was originally drafted has been heard in the House, and I will go through a very, very brief description of Senate File 509, and then there will be a, for better description of the bill, we have a short film that is a better, probably a better description than what I can even do. So I'd like to just go through the bill very quickly and then go right to the film, if that's all right with you. Mr. Chairman, Article 1 of the bill regards voter registration, photo identification, and provisional balloting. It does require a photo identification, and it does make means for those who are not or who cannot afford a photo identification the means to be provided one free of charge. There are verification of registration requirements on it, and provisional ballots will be very much like the provisional balloting that's allowed now. Article 2. Oh, by the way, there is a penalty for unlawful voting, and it's similar to existing law that it would be a felony in the event that one would illegally cast a vote. Article 2 regards the election administration and the integrity of this system. Using a statewide voter registration system, the establishment of that, administrative rules, that require legislative approval for such a system. There are other elements such as registration files, the retention of records, the entry of voter registration information into the statewide voter registration system. We use an acronym SVRS. If I happen to mention that, that means statewide voter registration system. It does accumulate the voting history, not the actual vote, but whether or not someone actually does employ their right to vote, just like it is done now in public record. Furthermore, it involves itself with absentee balloting and healthcare patients and also retention of records. There are ballot boards that are established to continue maintaining the requirements for absentee ballot boards. The election judge rules will have to slightly be changed in order to recognize the system that we're suggesting. Electronic rosters are also necessary in this type of hardware that we're introducing, and that would also include the polling place rosters, procedures for polling place standards regarding electronic rosters. It updates language to reflect the use of electronic polling place rosters also. It does get rather complicated as we continue to go through this, and that's why it would be helpful to have a very short movie that reflects just about everything that we're doing.
Mr. Chair.
Other than that, we also have procedures for recounts.
Okay. Senator Sieben, did you have a question?
Yes, I did. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Limmer, so are you describing the delete all amendment we have before us or the bill itself?
No, the bill itself for now.
And are you going, so is your intention to talk about the bill as introduced and then later adopt the delete all, or at some point could you differentiate between the two since they're both
Mr. Chairman,
big bills?
Senator Limmer.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Sieben, probably the best way to describe the delete everything will first be to have an understanding of the bill itself and where we're going. Once the film is played, then we will be getting into the DE3 amendment. That is a delete everything amendment. And it gives you kind of a before and after. So if you can indulge us for a few minutes, I think it'll all come together for you. Mr. Chairman, I think at this time I'd like to introduce Mr. Lee McGrath for a short movie, and that'll give the members a little better idea of where we're going.
Thank you. Is Mr. McGrath here?
Dan,
could you come
Dan,
up to the...
It's Dan McGrath. I'm sorry.
Come up to the table and... you could state your name and title for the record, please.
Yes, hello. I'm Dan McGrath with Minnesota Majority, Executive Director, Mr. Chairman.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Well, I'll just get right into the short film that Senator Limmer referred to.
A lot changed during the 20th century. Advancements in technology enabled dramatic improvements in terms of the speed, cost, and quality of business and government operations. Portions of Minnesota's election system took advantage of these technological developments, including how voter registration records were stored and how ballots were tabulated. However, much of today's election system still remains unchanged from the time of the early 20th century. A 21st century voter ID bill has been introduced in the Minnesota State Legislature. The objective of this bill is to modernize our election system in order to improve the integrity, efficiency, and effectiveness of Minnesota's elections. Let's take a moment and compare today's election system to some of the changes proposed in the 21st century voter ID bill. Today, when a voter enters a polling place, they are typically directed to one of two different queues, one for pre-registered voters and one for unregistered voters who wish to register to vote on election day. Unregistered voters must wait in line to fill out a voter registration form. During busy periods, a person may need to wait 30 minutes or more to complete a voter registration. Election judges routinely report instances of people becoming frustrated with the wait times and leaving the polling place without voting. Voters registering on election day must use one of three methods to confirm their identity and their address. First, they may present an approved form of photo identification. Second, they may provide a recent utility bill that includes their current address. Or third, they may have a registered voter from the precinct accompany them to vouch for their identity and their residence. Individuals who lack one of these three forms of identification are turned away from voting. This approach to identity verification has some problems. In vouching, for example, one person can vouch for up to 15 people in a single election. Poll watchers routinely report stories of individuals attempting to vouch for multiple individuals who they apparently don't even know. There have also been reports of individuals attempting to use forged utility bills in order to register to vote. After the election, handwritten voter registration forms must be data entered into the statewide voter registration system, or SVRS. State and federal law requires that these new registrations be immediately entered. However, some counties are consistently late in meeting these statutory deadlines, often requiring 6 months or more to complete the data entry. After the registration forms have been entered into SVRS, a postal verification card, or PVC, is printed and mailed to every newly registered voter as a means of verifying their identity and their address. In a typical statewide election, upwards of 500,000 PVCs are printed and mailed. If these cards were piled on top of one another, the stack would be taller than a 30-story office building. If a postal verification card is not returned as undeliverable by the Postal Service, the newly registered voter is deemed to be valid. Return cards must be data entered so that the voter's registration can be flagged and challenged in the next election. Now keep in mind that this verification step is not completed until several weeks after the election has already taken place and the individual's ballot has been cast and counted. In 2008, there were over 23,000 postal verification cards from Election Day registrations that were returned as undeliverable by the Postal Service. Including the return cards from pre-election registrants, the number increases to over 32,000 undeliverable cards. A sampling of these return cards revealed voter registration addresses that include sections of freeway, empty lots, city parks, business warehouses, and non-existent house numbers. Keep in mind that this occurred in a year in which several major election battles were decided by just a few hundred votes. One other point to keep in mind is that there's currently no eligibility verification performed for voters who register to vote on Election Day. Individuals may be ineligible to vote for a variety of reasons, including felons who are still on parole, non-citizens, individuals who are under guardianship, or out-of-state residents. A review of 2008 election records revealed thousands of ineligible voters that may have participated in the 2008 election. It took nearly 2 years for these persons to be identified. Keep in mind again that these individuals' ballots had already been cast and counted. Now let's go back and look at the election day process for pre-registered voters. Voters who enter the polling place line up by last name at the check-in table. Each voter signs in on an election roster. The roster is a list of all registered voters in the precinct. The list includes the person's name, address, and provides a place for the voter to sign in. Pre-registered voters are not currently required to present any form of identification. In today's system, a dishonest individual could travel from one precinct to another and sign in on any random line in an election roster, thereby voting multiple times in a single election. After the election, election officials scan a barcode next to the names of persons who have signed in on the roster, recording the fact that they voted in the election. This information is captured within the statewide voter registration system. Past experience has shown that election officials can make mistakes by scanning the wrong lines on the roster. This has resulted in people being recorded as having voted when they actually did not, including deceased individuals. Mistakes such as these not only impact the integrity of our election records, but also can adversely impact whether a voter registration continues to remain on the rolls. Now let's compare today's election system to the proposed changes included in the 21st Century Voter ID Bill. Let's begin with the Election Day registration process. New registrants will present their driver's license or state-issued identification card. The card will be swiped in a card reader. Information from the card will be electronically captured, and the voter's eligibility to vote will be immediately verified. The system will also automatically confirm that the individual is in the correct polling place. If not, it will print a map and directions to the appropriate polling place where the individual should vote. Data from the individual's identification card will automatically populate a voter registration form that is then printed and signed by the voter. The voter's registration information will be stored in the electronic poll book and uploaded to the SVRS system later that day. If an individual lacks an identification card, they will still be allowed to vote using a provisional ballot. No one will be turned away from the polls, which is currently the case for individuals who lack the appropriate form of identification. Individuals who use a provisional ballot to vote will be required to return to their local city or county office within 10 days after the election to confirm their identity and eligibility with a proper form of identification. The long lines of people waiting to manually complete a voter registration form will be a thing of the past. People who wish to register on Election Day will no longer simply give up on voting due to wait times. Since new voter registrations are electronically transferred to SVRS on Election Day, election workers will no longer need to spend hundreds of hours after the election to manually enter handwritten voter registration forms into SVRS. This will not only reduce errors, but also enable officials to comply with existing laws requiring the timely entry of new voter registrations. Gone, too, is the requirement for counties to print and mail postal verification cards to newly registered voters. The voter's identity and residence will be confirmed before they are given a ballot instead of after the fact. Now let's examine the process for registered voters. Individuals will present their driver's license or state identification card to an election official when checking in to vote. The election official will swipe the individual's card. The system will then automatically check to confirm the voter's eligibility to vote and record the fact that the person has voted. The voter's information will be automatically transferred to SVRS. All of this will occur in a matter of seconds. Gone is the need to print thousands of paper roster pages prior to Election Day. Gone is the need for voters to page through a paper roster looking for the appropriate line on which to sign in. Gone is the chance that someone could vote under another person's identity. Gone is the opportunity for someone to vote when they aren't eligible to do so. And gone is the need for election officials to scan rosters after the election in order to record that the individuals had voted. Let's recap the major benefits of the 21st Century Voter ID proposal. First, the proposal improves the integrity of our elections by verifying each voter's identity and eligibility before they are given a ballot, not after the fact. Second, the new system eliminates millions of dollars in wasteful government spending by eliminating the printing of tens of thousands of pages of election rosters, the data entry of 500,000 voter registration forms, the printing and mailing of hundreds of thousands of postal verification cards, and the scanning of thousands of pages of election rosters. Third, it speeds up the voting process, thereby eliminating the possibility for people to become disenfranchised and give up in trying to vote due to long lines. Fourth, the proposal improves the timeliness and accuracy of information used to administer our elections due to the elimination of manual data entry. Fifth, the new system eliminates the possibility of a voter being turned away from the polls due to a lack of the appropriate credentials through the use of provisional ballots. Finally, and possibly most important, the proposal improves the public confidence in our election systems. States that have implemented similar systems have seen an increase in their voter participation. Minnesota is one of the few states that allow for Election Day voter registration. Most other states require individuals to register at least 20 days in advance of an election so that the voter's identity and eligibility can be verified prior to them voting. Today, Minnesotans who register prior to Election Day are subject to a variety of eligibility verifications before they vote. However, Election Day registrants are not subject to these same verification checks until after their ballot has been cast and counted. Post-election research has revealed that many of the ineligible voters detected as having voted in our elections are the result of Election Day registrations. Minnesota's current approach to voter registration is fundamentally unjust because it treats two different groups of voters very differently. It also is insecure because there is no eligibility verification being done for Election Day registrants. Minnesotans' sense of fairness demands that this situation must be addressed. A recent poll reveals that 87% of Minnesotans believe that all newly registered voters should be subject to the same identity and eligibility verifications. The 21st Century Voter ID proposal solves this problem by employing real-time eligibility verifications for Election Day registrants. If this proposal is not adopted, the only alternative approach to correcting this injustice is to join with the majority of states that prohibit Election Day registration. 21st Century Voter ID is a proposal whose time has come to Minnesota. Please contact your elected officials and urge them to support this bill.
No clapping, please, and during the hearing. Thank you. Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, as we, Representative Kiffmeyer and I, have begun this road through the legislature, the House has already heard it in their committee, and we were very diligent in listening to the concerns, the questions, even some of the criticism that we heard in the House. Many of the people that are planning on giving testimony today, I'm sure they're planning on giving the same type of raising the same type of concern that was risen, that had arisen in the House. As a result of that, we've heard many of their concerns, and we've altered the bill slightly, and it's represented in the Delete Everything DE3 amendment that, as a member of this committee, I'd like to offer as an author's amendment.
Okay, Senator Limmer moves the DE3 amendment. Senate file 509.
Is that 15?
Mr. A-15. Chair?
Is it?
Ours says A-15.
I believe it's
A-15. Mr. Chairman?
Senator, is it the A-15? Senator Limmer.
Yes, that's correct. I was using a House language. It had a different number on it. But it's the same, substantive amendment, the A-15 amendment.
So things sometimes get messed up when you use the House stuff? Just kidding. Okay, Senator Limmer.
At this time, I'd like to introduce former Secretary of State Mary Kiffmeyer, also present State Representative Mary Kiffmeyer, to review the A-15 amendment with you at this time.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the Senate. I appreciate the opportunity to be with you today. As we know, both bodies do work together, and eventually you have conference committees or other matters, and one bill goes to the governor. So it is good that we do work together and have done so before on election bills when I served in my first term. So good to be with you today. The A-15 amendment that we have here, the Delete Everything Author's Amendment, is in principle the same as the bill that it is amending. In other words, the photo ID requirement, use of the electronic rosters, those things are essentially here. However, the initial fiscal note was a little bit more expensive, and so what we've tried to do here in working together is to preserve those elements and be able to do it in a way that gives some economy. And so with that, Mr. Chair, in particular, the voter ID cards, again, being done by the Department of Public Safety, but instead of using a regular Minnesota ID card, we are using a specially created voter ID card. And this would have the barcoding, but not the magnetic stripe. And so it just has some elements to it that, in working with the Department of Public Safety, this may be a free ID also, serve the same purpose, but it would only be able to be used for voting. It would have no other purpose. But as far as voting is concerned, it does serve that same purpose. And again, it is a state-subsidized voter identification card. There would be a special account in Minnesota Management and Budget, and would again be able to be used for voting, but only for voting. In regards to that section of the bill, it also does remove vouching. This is, again, the approach that the large number, overwhelming number of states support, and matter of fact, many other states like Minnesota are introducing during this same kind of legislative session. And so that would change, and that would be the same in this author's amendment as well. There are some other areas, such as provisional ballots. Again, in the original bill, there was provisional ballots. The language here has not changed. It is the same language that you would have seen in the original bill. In the next section, we do work on canvassing of the state primaries and the general election. We needed to be sure that in the counting of the provisional ballots, and just to let you know, the state of Wisconsin that also has implemented provisional ballots, there were 341 in the last election. So sometimes you hear about this being an overwhelming thing. It has not been the case, in particular to our neighboring Wisconsin. But we've worked to make sure that those dates and the timing of that counting, and so there is a couple wording or date changes there because I'm working with the offices to make sure that they fit in the sequence of the canvassing boards. Then if you continue to go through this also, there is language regarding the electric roster or a paper list provided by the county auditor or municipal clerk. And that is because in this particular bill, we give two ways to do this, again, keeping the same principle, one with paper, one with electronic roster. So on page 17, line 5, you would see the fact that we have accommodated that in the wording. In the registration files, again, we are making it more explicit. The Help America Vote Act, and this is on pages 18 and 19. In the Help America Vote Act, there is a requirement, federal law, been in place for a few years, that the voter registration applications must be entered immediately and on an expedited basis. 6 months is not immediate nor expedited. Minnesota law currently gives them 42 days unless the county auditor notifies that the deadline will not be met. That is currently being used, but I think after about 4 years, it is time that we recognize this federal law, and we are at risk of lawsuits if we don't bring this into line with federal law. So this is one step closer on page 19. And there's a couple other sections that address that issue as well. Then on page 20 and 21, there is the challenged eligibility list. This is the paper version of an electronic roster verification. So this is probably on page 20 at the bottom, section 13. This is a method that we have come up with that would accomplish or attempt to accomplish some of the same things that electronic roster would, but using a paper list. And the following pages, we again go to page 22 on application procedures. And again, this is just some language in regards to the changing of the driver's license, the Social Security number, and some of that language that also come up to it. On page 23 at the top, you will see line 1, it says, prior to approval, the county auditor or municipal clerk must verify. And then it goes on with some additional language. And again, this is the equal treatment of all voters. We don't realize that today on Election Day, voters come in, they don't have the same verifications prior to having a ballot that others in pre-registration go through. So we want to make sure that we treat voters equally, whether they have registered ahead of time or are doing so on Election Day. And that is a real key component to the approach of this bill. As we go on, the ballot board on page 24, this is similar language, but since this is your first hearing, what this does is ballot boards were started anew on a statewide basis in the 2010 election for the first time. There were some issues with that from citizen concerns, and especially with the fact that the public right to know and to observe the process of the absentee ballot accepting and rejecting process. So the language on page 24 is addressing some of those citizen concerns. The next page is having to do with recounts on page 25. And there on line 13 through 16, some language is stricken that in the recounts, we believe that many times when you're making a decision to go to a contest, if you don't have the ability to view records, it's difficult to make a legal decision about what next step to take. So this addresses that issue. I'm also realizing that Section 20, this is a section that actually is deleted in the House version, and Section 20, Mr. Chair, I would recommend when you deal with this bill on Wednesday that we read through this but missed this one, and it appears as though it has been mistakenly left in. And this has to do with physical assistance in marking ballots. And, Mr. Chair and members, in regards to this, I have a sister who has a disability. I'm her co-guardian. Right now, she has a mental age of 4, but right now, according to current Minnesota law, I could bring her in as her guardian, and I assure you, my sister would vote in the way I would instruct her to. It would not be her vote. She would not have the capacity to read, to understand, or to comprehend. But according to Minnesota current law, that would be her ability. She would be able to vote by Minnesota current law. But this Section 20 is not the way that I would deal with this issue. Since this language, we have come up with other language in a separate standalone bill, Mr. Chairman. So I hope that kind of clarifies that. And for anybody who is here in regards to that, that Section 20 on page 25 is meant to be stricken. On Section 21, determination of proper number, this is has to do, you know, as the previous 2010 election, the reconciling of ballots and making those counts, those proper counts, were quite a contentious issue. And so on Section 21 is determination of the proper number, counting the number of original voter signatures contained in the polling place roster or on voter receipts generated from an electronic roster. The electronic roster does issue a paper receipt that does have the voter's name, the voter's Secretary of State ID number, and a place for a signature, unlike the current slips of paper that are just that, slips of paper, which has no tie-in to either the roster or to the final tally. This type of receipt would be able to be specific and would have legal standing as far as being counted as a receipt because it would include the voter signature. So that is Section 21. Section 22 allows that excess ballots and some of those issues may be the basis of a challenge. And Section 23 is also having to do with recounts. And again, this is just some areas of clarification. Going down to Section 25, this has to do with being a little more specific about, as you know, many of you know, there are separate envelopes for defective ballots. This adds a separate envelope for spoiled and duplicate ballots. Continuing on, there are some more areas where we deal with excess ballots and being just a little bit more specific. So as the realization from the court the last time, when they compared the rules and the statute, there were some issues that were conflicting with one another. By adding this language and striking some in this bill, we clarify and make the language more specific so that in the advent of a recount, we have clarity for our election administrators. Continuing on page 28 and page 29, again, the sometimes the language is just cleaning up some old language on 2915, unused ballot cards. We now just call them ballots. As we continue forward, the again, in regards to the area of recounts on page 30, appointment of inspectors. Again, it gives the opportunity in a recount for all materials relating to the election, including but not limited to polling place rosters. And again, many times our sense was that if there was more access, and this is to inspect, not to touch, not to copy, not to mark, not to do anything with it, but to at least be able to have the access to inspect them, that we might have less of a recount because some of those issues could be cleared up through that inspection. And then on Section 32, on page 31, this is an area that there was testimony in regards to battered women's shelters receiving assistance. And as Secretary of State, I work to have implemented the Safe at Home program, address confidentiality for battered women who are seeking shelter. This was a program that also gave them a secure and private absentee ballot with a special address. And this is administered through the Secretary of State office. What this does in Section 32 is requiring that information be provided to all battered women receiving assistance from a shelter, and that they would be able to be given an application for the program and information on the right of those individuals to vote by absentee ballot as permitted by current statute. We believe this is many of the battered women that testified to the Save at Home Address Confidentiality Program testified also that they did not want to go to a polling place for fear of their safety. So that is why the original Safe at Home program was created. I believe this is an improved part of the process to make sure that we are able to capture their vote as well. Section 33 is some repealing of rules. This has to do with the recount process and we realize that in many times there's a conflict between statute and rules. What most citizens do is they read the statute. Getting to the rules is just another step that for regular citizens is a bit more difficult. By putting these things into statute and make sure that they are all together in one place for ease of use, I believe by both administrators and by regular citizens. That is the end of Article 2. Article 3 has to do with the electronic rosters. This language in regards to the electronic rosters is primarily the same. What has changed is the scope of using electronic rosters. And in this particular situation, we are applying the use of electronic rosters to counties with a registered voter population of 75,000 or higher, exempting all townships and cities with 25,000 or more registered voters. So what we're doing here is trying to reduce the scope of the use of electronic rosters, and also by using larger counties, this is something that the greater delay of data entry is mostly occurring in larger counties. So this enables us to address that specific problem doing it this way, and the other entities would be able to use that election day verification by using the paper lists. And so, Mr. Chairman, this is Article 3 on the electronic rosters, and that is, other than that, the electronic rosters are also the same. On page 41, Section 17, there is a legislative task force on electronic roster implementation. And again, this is listening to those who had some concerns about its implementation and having an ability, as a success we had a year or so ago, in putting together a legislative task force. And I know that there are probably at least one or two senators possibly in the room who participated with that. This is an effort to, again, have a legislative task force to work on the implementation of the electronic rosters for use in elections. So the task force would be made up of and would study in particular and recommend options for hardware, software updates, add-ons, and recommend to the legislature any additional changes. The task force would have 17 members, explicitly stated as here. And also a report to the legislature by December 1st of this year so that we would have time in the legislature to adapt to any recommendations that might be brought forward by this legislative task force. The other change that is in this statute is we had taken an approach of going out for bid for software for the electronic rosters. But I'm remembering that while I was Secretary of State implementing the new state voter registration system, we designed the software system to be compatible with either an exterior software using for electronic rosters, or this could be an in-house created software. And so the language that is in this author's amendment from Senator Limmer allows for the Secretary of State office and internal IT staff to take the approach of internally creating the software module to be used for electronic rosters. There are certain advantages to that, found before that our staff in the IT department were excellent. Much of the code and the folks who built that system are still employees there, are very knowledgeable and very helpful, and that this might be a quite a bit more inexpensive route to go in having the benefit of the software for electronic rosters. And so we have taken that approach. Also, that means that we would not have some of the licensing, the maintenance, contracting, and other issues that go with an external software purchase. So this is an effort, again, to respond to the fiscal note and to seek a way to accomplish the same principles and the same goals in a less expensive route. Article 4, again, has to do with recounts and some areas of the state canvassing board, and is not any different than the language on the initial bill that folks may be familiar with. And Senator Limmer, with that, I do have some other comments, but I don't know if you want me to make my comments at this time or to take questions.
Senator Limmer, we're going to any further discussion on the A15 amendment?
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Limmer.
There was a suggestion that on page 25, section 20, we're working on different language that this bill should not cover, and I would like to move that we strike the language in section 20 on pages 25. The new language on 25 be stricken as an author's amendment. Mr. Chair.
Just then.
Sorry about that.
Delete section 20.
So.
Delete the section 20. I think the amendment would be for the whole section instead of just the new language. Because it takes everything out, you don't want to leave just the old language in there.
Okay. Well, we're being advised to just delete the whole section. Section 20, is that?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, Senator Limmer moves to delete section 20 of the DE A15 amendment.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Kalish.
I'm just
welcome
a
to the
little
committee,
bit,
by the way, Senator.
Thank you.
Officially.
Thanks.
Go ahead.
I'm just a little bit confused. Was the motion to delete all the changes in section 20 or the whole section?
Senator Limmer.
I got two different.
I believe it's to delete section 20. Is that?
So we have
that's
no
correct
rule and no language then to deal with folks with disabilities?
From the amendment.
I'm glad this is right.
From the amendment.
But right now, just strike it, yeah.
Just strike it.
Which you do care.
Well, strike it.
Just the, from the amendment, it wouldn't repeal the law.
If you strike,
I'm sorry, okay.
If you strike the whole section, it deletes everything.
Any further discussion to the amendment to the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. To the A15 amendment. Any further discussion? Senator Sieben?
Well, Mr. Chair, I do have questions about the delete all amendment, but do you want to adopt it to get it in the shape the bill he'd like first? Or
if that's okay with you, that would be my preference. Further discussion to adoption? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A15 amendment say aye.
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 Opposed? Amendment is adopted. Senator Sieben.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And Senator Limmer and Representative Kiffmeyer, this is an unusual way to hold a hearing with both of you up here, and maybe it will make it easier since if your intent is to move the bills, I guess my first question would be, what is your intent then, that the Senate bill will always match up with the House bill? You know, just move it forward and keep them out the same as possible, or?
Chairman?
It's kind of a new process.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Sieben, this is a presentation today. The committee will be having time to discuss and even amend this bill on Wednesday. I believe that's the plan for the chairman. And we're just trying to put our language as close as possible at the early phase of our committee. And we'll certainly have time to discuss and amend on Wednesday.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question.
Senator Sieben.
Then I'll address it to both of you, or you, Senator Limmer. Regarding the repeal of the rules in, I forgot, in Section 33 of the Delete All, why repeal all of the rules ever adopted? And what is the intent behind, I mean, I'd really actually like to see all these rules if we're going to repeal them all, but how is that in the legislature's best use of our time to repeal all of these laws, which I assume some of them will need to come back to the legislature to later be adopted? Senator Limmer, what's the point of repealing all of these
Chair, I'm gonna
all election laws
have
rules ever done?
Representative Kiffmeyer address this section.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Senator Steven. If you recall from 2010, we did the same kind of approach in passing election law in 2010, where we worked closely together, the House and the Senate, just to address the fact that there's precedent for doing it this way as we worked together in 2010, just to address that first thing. In regards to the repealer, as I explained when I went through this, that we have taken the things from these rules and put them into statute, and so that makes the rules unnecessary. In other words, they will be in statute instead of in rules.
In this legislation?
In this legislation, yes.
Mr. Chair, a follow-up
Senator
then.
Steven.
So all of these rules that you are repealing are covered in other areas of the Delete All Amendment, just to clarify.
Senator Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Senator. Mr. Chairman, Senator Steven, yes, that is the intention of this, is that in order to make, when you are working with these things, that the language that we have here, the purpose and the intent is that everything would be placed into statute. Now, we don't just copy the rules. We take the essential content of them and put them in statute.
Mr. Chair and Representative Kiffmeyer, my understanding from hearing from some local election officials was that some of these rules that you're attempting to repeal are very, very tiny things that are important for election administration, but that aren't addressed. I don't know about the delete all, but just from looking through it, are not addressed in the, at least the Senator Limmer bill as introduced, things like the size of the font on a specific ballot or the weight of the paper, things like that, that you are repealing here, so then would need subsequent legislation to fix that in the future. But you're saying that that's not correct, that in fact all of these rules that are listed on page 31 and 32 are covered in other sections of the delete all.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Senator Steven. If it inadvertently there has been anything here that is essential to election administration, then that would be restored. The intention was not to take away anything that was essential to election administration.
Well, Mr. Chair, then.
Senator Steven.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, I'd say then I think we might need to review what's essential with some of the local election officials, and maybe they can comment on that when they give their testimony. And also, Representative Kiffmeyer, I just wanted to counter a little bit what you said about the election reform legislation we passed last year. We did work in a bipartisan process that was started well before session began. There were members of the House and the Senate from the majority and the – yes, it is true, Representative Kiffmeyer was at the meetings.
I didn't disagree with you.
Well, it is true because I was there, and there were Republicans from both bodies in those meetings. And so – you're comparing this legislation to that, which I should say, and also I would just add that that legislation was ultimately passed overwhelmingly by both the House and the Senate and signed into law by Governor Pawlenty. I would also say that this legislation, I would challenge you on your premise that you worked in a similar fashion, because I'm not aware of any Democrats that have been approached to work with you to try to really craft some sort of bipartisan legislation that would move our state forward in terms of strengthening the integrity of our election system.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Limmer.
Just so there is no question, Senator Steven, you made a comment trying to correct Representative Kiffmeyer. She whispered to me as you made the first made that question, she said, I can address this too. Not
Sorry.
That this is not true.
Okay.
So I just want to make sure that we leave with the proper character of discussion here.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Senator Steven, and I appreciate that clarification of the words being spoken. If you remember, in 2009, it wasn't quite the same, was it?
No.
And so what I was referring to, and I said specifically about 2010, that in 2010 that was indeed the case, but I remember also that between 2009 and 2010 is where we had the interim work group, and that is my effort at the legislative task force that is in the author's amendment to recreate that same approach by having us together in the interim.
Okay. Further discussion, Senator Kaler.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer, this has a fiscal note of about $36 million. Is that, I don't know if the amendment changes any of that or not. I'm just curious about that. And the other question is, where's the money coming from? Which budget's going to get cut $36 million in order for this to be approved? And
well, Mr. Chairman, the fiscal note that you have before you is the one for the original bill. We're awaiting the fiscal note on the modified version that represented in the amendment. We thought that it would be here by today, but it has not developed.
Okay.
So by Wednesday, we hope to have it. It'll be hopefully considerably less than what the figure we have before us.
Senator Kalish, and then I remind you, we do have a large number of testifiers.
The other question, because we're talking about having fairness across the board, is that it's my understanding that some of these polling places will have the electronic ability to do the electronic and others will not. And that it just depends on how big the polling place is that happens. So why aren't we back to the same point you're trying to solve?
Senator Limmer.
Mr. Chairman, we're not changing eligibility of anyone voting. That doesn't change at all. This is an accounting process. This is how we account for the votes in Minnesota and make sure that we have a method that represents the finest integrity a modern world could provide. Now, we know there are some limitations with our funding capability at this time. So for those communities that are large enough where you get an economy of scale, we would use the electronic counting system that's presented here. In other communities that may not have the economy of scale, and to keep the cost down, that accounting is going to continue as it does now. So it's simply a method of accounting more than change in policy.
Senator Howe.
Mr. Chair, senators, I'm here to advocate for Senate File 479. Not to take away anything from Senator Limmer's bill, but Senator Livermore's bill is the Cadillac plan. Mine's more the Ford truck, tough and durable. It'll get the job done at a lot lower cost. I'm sure you've all read the bill and the overview, so I'll just briefly go over the bill. First off, what Senate File 479 does not do is it does not change the way we do our absentee balloting or our absentee voting. It does not change what we do in terms of outreach for the disabled community and for the senior living community. And it should not negatively impact voter turnout. What would be required under Senate File 479 is that you'd present a photo ID at the ballot at your polling place. You could use a Minnesota valid driver's license or identification card, a valid U.S. passport, a valid Minnesota voter identification card, or any valid identification issued by a branch, department, agency, entity, or subdivision of the state of Minnesota or the federal government if the identification includes a photograph of the voter or also a valid tribal identification card with a photograph of the voter. What would be if you show up at a polling place and do not have a voter ID, or if you've lost your driver's license and or just forgot that you left your billfold at home when you showed up at the polling place, you'd be issued a provisional ballot. And with the provisional ballot, the person would cast their election or their choices on the election ballot, and that provisional ballot would be then sent to the county auditor's office. The person casting a provisional ballot would have 5 business days, or in essence 7 days, to come to the auditor's office and just provide identification of who they are in the normal sequence. And they could also just sign an affidavit attesting to the validity of their vote. This would be, my bill certainly embraces the less is more. As you can see, the bill itself is very short. It would allow a free voter identification card, and a person could just stop at their county auditor's office. The actual cost for the equipment would be about $413,000 statewide. But we do have a significant amount of money, approximately $2.7 million for voter identification, or for voter education, excuse me, for voter education, and I think we could probably implement that for less. But with that, I'll stand for any questions.
Thank you. Senator Sieben.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Howe, thank you for that presentation. You said that voters who don't have an ID could just stop by their county auditor's office. In a lot of, especially rural areas, Minnesotans get their state ID cards at deputy registrar offices, often because the county office is a good distance away. Would people who don't have valid IDs under your legislation be able to get one of these IDs at a deputy registrar office?
Senator Howe.
Mr. Chair and Senator Sieben, that currently is not contained, but that is a discussion that we're having, and it might be that DPS might be the proper place for this. As you know, a senior can get a regular state-issued ID card for approximately $11 at a DPS, and I think just a regular Minnesota state ID is $18. So this would be provided free of cost. We'd have to do a fiscal analysis of that to see what that would cost in DPS to see if they could absorb that. That might be the proper place because it could actually provide for a greater revenue enhancement when the person, if they're just coming in for the free voter ID card, it can't be used for check cashing, it can't be used for any other identification purposes other than for voting. They may decide, you know, I'll spend a few extra dollars and actually get an identification card that I can use for traveling or I can use for check cashing purposes or what have you. So I think that is a very good suggestion.
Thank you. Senator Sieben.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Howe, could you just talk about your overall philosophy and what problem is your legislation specifically trying to solve? So is it... Well, I don't want to answer for you. If you could please answer that.
Mr. Chair and Senator Sieben, my bill proposes to alleviate the fear that your vote is not being counted correctly and that there's integrity in our election. And I think there's significant overwhelming response that people want voter ID. I think for the most part, most people, when they show up at a polling place, assume they have to show a voter ID. Most people pull out their ID ahead of time. So this is just a low-cost way of making sure that we don't have disenfranchised voters, people that think that there isn't integrity in our voting system. And I would think that voting in our state should rise at least to the same level of integrity of getting on an airplane and flying out of Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport. So I do believe that it does achieve multiple things, and probably the most is that the public feels that their vote has integrity at the polling place.
Senator Sieben.
Thank you, Mr.
Then
Chair.
I think we are going to go on to some testimony. We'll have time for member questions after that. Go ahead.
Thank you. I disagree with you a little bit in terms of the difference between voting and getting on an airplane, just in that voting is actually defined in our Constitution as a right of people, and getting on an airplane certainly is different and not defined in our U.S. or Minnesota Constitution. It seems to me, and perhaps we'll hear from some of the testifiers to this, that, and this came up this morning when I was at the Dakota County Jail speaking with some inmates, that people think that, the general public thinks that felons are voting in large numbers. And if you could just address if that's a concern of yours, or, and if it is, then how does showing a driver's license or still being allowed to vote by absentee address that issue?
Senator Howell.
Mr. Chair and Senator Sieben, I also worked at the Department of Corrections. I don't suppose to answer the question as far as how would it affect known felons, but I would believe that with the ID, with the voter ID, you do have a record of where the person lives. It's the same with absentee ballot. Can somebody still go and intentionally defraud? Can a felon still go, and if he or she deems to, that wants to circumvent the system, I believe it would happen. So I don't think you're going to prevent all fraud, but this is a big step in the right direction. This is a low cost way of providing voter ID, and
Senator Reinhart, did you want to jump in there, or are you?
Okay. Mr. Chair, could I just follow up real quickly?
Sure, Senator Sieben.
Thank you. Thanks for your indulgence. And Senator Howe, in 2008, a survey of county attorneys that was done across Minnesota found that in the 38 instances of voter fraud, all 38 of those, or 100%, were cases of felons voting. So I just think that that's a, you know, certainly we need to do whatever we can to make sure that that's not happening. And I just wanted to point out that I don't think that your legislation gets at that, at those 100% of the cases of actual fraud taking place, that your legislation doesn't address that, and that it wouldn't, like you said, it wouldn't catch all of those instances or any of them.
Okay. Did you have any comments, Senator Howell? Okay. Senator Reinhart,
Mr. Chair, I'll speak to Senator Howell offline.
Thank you. Dan McGrath. Are you here? Welcome to the committees. Please state your name again for the tape.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Dan McGrath, Executive Director of Minnesota Majority. Once again, our organization has been researching the state of Minnesota's election system for over 2 years now. And what we found is concerning. It should be common sense that combining election day voter registration with vouching creates an environment that isn't worthy of our trust. How fast do you think your bank accounts would empty if someone could access your account on the say-so of a friend, no identification required? And we really believe that our votes, which control billions and trillions of public dollars, would never be stolen just because it's a felony. Stealing a car is also a felony, but I'm guessing that everyone here uses an ignition key instead of a notice on the window of your car that says, warning, stealing this car is a felony. From information we obtained from the Secretary of State's office, Minnesota Majority determined that nearly 5% of Election Day registrants in 2008 provided information that could not subsequently be verified as true and correct through the use of a postal verification card. As the video explained, if a PVC is successfully mailed to a new voter, the voter's information is assumed valid, but if it's returned as undeliverable mail, the voter is flagged for challenge at the next election. Of over 500,000 Election Day registrations in 2008, more than 23,000 of them were subsequently flagged for challenge because of a returned PVC card after their votes were counted. Thanks to changes in election administration law enacted last year, the Secretary of State now provides a report to the legislative committees, like this one, with oversight over elections, that document the number of voters referred to county attorneys for investigation due to a return postal verification card. That report was completed on March 1st, and as of that date, 399 suspect voters had been referred to county attorneys for investigation from the 2010 election. Our current election day registration rules essentially put less responsible voters at the front of the line. Election day registrants are not subject to the same scrutiny as voters who register in advance of an election. A recent poll conducted by the Terrence Group found that 87% of voters think election day registrants should be subject to the same scrutiny and verification as those who register in advance of an election. The 21st century voter ID bill enables that verification instantly. Voter ID will prevent the use of fictitious identities at the polls, but it will not by itself prevent ineligible voters like non-residents, non-citizens, and ineligible felon voters. Voter ID is a necessary first step, but only a first step. 21st century voter ID with electronic poll book completes the journey. As you may be aware, there have recently been about 100 convictions for voting by ineligible people in the 2008 election. Now, Senator Sieben mentioned 38. That's based upon inaccurate or actually outdated information, I should say. The numbers continue to tick up. I have personally polled the county attorneys for information on how many convictions they've obtained from 2008 election, how many currently under investigation, how many are charged awaiting trial. There's about 100 convictions to date from 2008. This has taken over 2 years to get to this point, by the way, and it's still ticking up. 100 are awaiting trial right now that have been charged, and hundreds more are still being investigated. In addition, the same report that's the source of that number 38 from Citizens for Election Integrity also exonerates Minnesota Majority's initial claim of 2,803 ineligible felon voters. They found that the number one reason that some voters were not charged was not because they were not ineligible, but because they couldn't prove that the voter knew they were ineligible to vote. That's a key component in our election law, is you have to knowingly violate the law in order to be convicted of it. Regardless, those were ineligible votes that never should have been cast and counted and influenced the election in a pretty alarming way when you consider how tight the margins were in some of the races in 2008. It's far better to stop voter fraud before it happens than try to catch it after a vote has already been counted. I would like to offer myself up for questions. I have quite a plethora of information about our election system and the fraud that's occurred in 2008, 2010, and weaknesses in the system. With that, I'll conclude my remarks. I'm happy to take questions.
Okay, questions, Senator Kalish.
Mr. Chair, Mr. McGrath,
I'm sorry, Senator Sieben was first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just wanted to know where you got that number of the 23,000 return PVCs.
Mr. Chair,
Mr. McGrath.
Senator Sieben, I did a data practices request to the Secretary of State's office requesting a list of everyone who had been flagged for challenge as a result of a postal verification card return. And as part of that electronic file that they provided, it had the election dates, the method of registration of each voter, and we just did a simple count. Everyone that had registered to vote in 2008 with an election day registration that was flagged for challenge, count them up, 23,000 and some odd.
Senator Kalish.
To that similar number, one of the things that you testified to is that it can take up to 6 months for the postal verification card to go out. So my question then is that isn't it possible a huge percentage of these folks have moved, especially in the more transient populations, so that number is really not as big as what you're saying?
Mr. McGrath.
Yeah, absolutely. Some people do have a PVC card returned because they have moved. As I mentioned, from the 2010 election, the Secretary of State has produced a report to this legislative body that shows the county auditors have attempted to ascertain the reason for PVC returns. If they can't ascertain a reasonable reason, such as they have moved, then they forward it to the county attorneys for investigation, criminal investigation. And just as of March 1st, 399 such names have been referred for investigation. So clearly not every return postal verification card is the result of someone moving. And in the video, we've got some pictures of properties that were clearly not residential at all that were the reason for a PVC card being returned.
Okay. Harrington.
Chairman, just a quick question, Mr. McGrath. How many people did you say were charged with voter fraud?
Mr. Chairman. charged for voter fraud in total or from the 2008 election, 2010 election, but I'm not exactly sure what number you're looking for.
You threw out a number. You said that Senator Sieben's number was incorrect. I'm wondering what number you placed in its instead.
Oh, thank you. Yes, so the 2008 election, I think, is what we're talking about here because those investigations are still underway. There have been approximately 200 individuals charged from our list of 2,803 that were provided to the county attorneys. 100 approximately have been convicted to date. I think it's probably higher now because my information is also a little bit old and some cases have probably already had their trials. And there are still hundreds additional under investigation, according to the county attorneys.
Okay. And while I haven't polled all the county attorneys in all 87 counties, the county attorneys I have talked to also did verify or did validate your statement that most of those weren't chargeable because it was simply a mistake. Is that accurate?
Mr. McGrath?
Well, the suspected ineligible felon voters claimed that they did not know that they could not vote. And the county attorneys have a very, very difficult task of proving intent. If you insist that you don't know that it's illegal, it's hard to prove that. It's hard to prove otherwise. So in most cases where people have claimed ignorance, the county attorneys declined to prosecute.
We have several other testifiers I'd like to get them in. Thank you, Mr. McGrath.
One more follow-up, please.
Senator Harrington.
Given your number of saying 100, given the smaller number on the Howell bill, am I correct in saying that we would then be spending about $48,000 per ineligible voter? And that's on the low end of the bill, not the $38 or $40 million bill where we're talking, I think, almost $400,000 per person that is ineligible. Is that, would that be my math correct?
Mr. McGrath.
Senator, thank you for the question. In addition to the 100 that have been charged, over 2,000 ineligible voters still slip through the system that just weren't charged. That influences the process in a way that our law did not design, and I don't think that the public is comfortable with. In addition, we have the problem with postal verification cards, which indicate potential fictitious identities being used to cast ballots, made-up addresses, non-existent people. And those are people that can never be caught because even though we can detect that it's happened, if I register to vote and say my name is Mickey Mouse, your county attorney is now chasing after Mickey Mouse. They're not going to find Dan McGrath.
Thank you, Mr. McGrath. We'll move on to the next testifier.
Thank you.
Mr. Andy Selig. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Selig. Please state your name for the record, please.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Andy Selig. I am the executive director of the Minnesota Voters Alliance.
Thank you. You can proceed with your testimony.
Okay. I want to thank you for giving me this opportunity. And for full disclosure, I want to mention that Representative Mary Kiffmeyer does serve on our board of advisors and has so done so for the past 3 or 4 years. And we're happy to have her on our board with the knowledge that she has in this area. But I wanted to just talk about a couple things here, and I'll keep it very brief. The question here, I think, is does our current system do a sufficient job at detecting or deterring voter fraud? As the U.S. Supreme Court had said in Crawford versus Marion County Board of Elections, the electoral system cannot inspire public confidence if no safeguards exist to detect or deter voter fraud. I just came back yesterday from a business trip to Las Vegas, and the best analogy I can come up with, someone alluded to taking an airplane, that this isn't the same. I would argue that this is no different than taking an airplane. How many in this room would fly on an airplane if we didn't make sure of the people on that plane that they were who they said they were in the terminal at their destination? I don't think there's anybody in this room that would get on that airplane. I don't think anybody, any citizen in Minnesota should have to go to vote, our right to vote, that should be taken any less lightly than getting on an airplane. Okay, that is my opinion. Our forefathers fought and died for the right to vote. which allows us to participate in the political landscape, also to hold our elected officials accountable. Now, I just wanted to make sure for the record that that was stated, but does our current system detect and deter voter fraud? That's what I want everybody to at least have a little understanding of why I think it doesn't. We talked a little bit about postal verification cards, okay? Our system sends out postal verification cards to all the folks who register during election year, including on election day. We know approximately, according to data practices act requests and responses from the Secretary of State's office, nearly 30,000 ballots were counted. And we know what we do? We flag them and we check them in the next election. I would submit to you that when the Supreme Court wrote this opinion and talked about detecting and deterring voter fraud, that they in no way were talking about detecting it in the next election. I absolutely think that that is an absurd statement. But back to a couple other things. We also talked a little bit about voter fraud and 100 felons and all this other stuff. I would submit to you that 30,000 postal verification cards is a little bit more alarming when you stop and think about a group called ACORN, who has been indicted in over 14 states, is under investigation and many more, is responsible, according to news reports themselves, that they registered the majority of those people. Folks, people are not, they don't have confidence in our election system. And that's what the Supreme Court was talking about. I want to hold these up. We have a petition going in St. Paul. One way or another, we think photo ID will get passed.
Mr. Clegg, if you could finish up, please.
All right, I will close. These are 3,000 notarized signatures in St. Paul. Clearly, the public has no confidence, nor should they have, in our current election. Finally, in closing, there are many, many issues that reasonable and honest people can disagree on. And in my opinion, the concept of this, you can argue about little points, but the concept of this is not one of those issues. Thank you.
Thank you. Our next testifier is Katie Common. Welcome to the committee. If you could state your name for the tape, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I am Katie Conlon, Interim Social Concerns Director for the Minnesota Catholic Conference. The MCC is the public policy voice of the Catholic Church of Minnesota. You have my written testimony, so I'm not going to read it all to you. I really just came to voice our organization's concerns that, despite the good intentions of these bills, that they could potentially disenfranchise people. And you've all heard data about what kinds of folks tend to not have photo IDs, and it's pretty surprisingly high numbers, no matter which study you look at. And so we're here to ask that before you change the way people get to vote in Minnesota, which is a fundamental right, that you really consider who could be shut out and think about whether or not you could maybe change these bills so that there's a little more outreach and maybe even a little bit more assistance to help people access the polls when they are eligible voters. I've heard kind of some different ideas kicked around that maybe there could be some funding to help people get their supporting documents, some funding to help reach out to people with transportation to make sure that they can get to the right authorities in the right kind of time frame that they need to get there. But if we can just remember that it's just not the case that every eligible voter in our state has photo ID, has access to their personal documents, or has access to transportation that they would need to be able to fulfill these new requirements. And I'm happy to take any questions if you have any.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Conlon, I'm wondering if you can refresh my memory. It seems to me that at one time Catholic Charities testified that they have photo IDs for their homeless shelters, for men and women who are in their homeless shelters. Do I have the correct institution? Is that true?
Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson, I actually represent the Minnesota Catholic Conference, which is actually a separate organization from Catholic Charities, so I cannot speak on their behalf.
Okay. Thank you.
So Ms. Conlon, how would you suggest we make sure that the people voting are who they say they are, since you do need an ID to get cigarettes and buy beer and cash a check? It just seems like a very common thing, and do you have any suggestions on an easier way that we can identify people?
Mr. Chair, I'm definitely not an elections expert. I think one of the best ways to do it would be actually to, and again, I'm not an expert on how counties could go about doing this or whether there's a better authority that could do it, but of having assistance available to help people make sure that they can get the documents that they need, whether that be a birth certificate or, you know, citizenship documents, whatever it is, in case they don't personally have copies of those things. And also that if we could remember that voting is not a privilege. It's a fundamental right. It's one of the most strongly protected rights in this country. And so it's really not comparable to buying cigarettes or getting on an airplane or buying alcohol or any of those other things. None of those are fundamental rights.
Thank you. Any other questions for the witness? Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Ms. Nelson? Teresa Nelson? Welcome to the committee. If you could state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Teresa Nelson, and I am legal counsel for the ACLU of Minnesota. We are funded and supported by over 8,500 members statewide. Our mission is to defend constitutional rights under the U.S. and Minnesota constitutions. Voting is a fundamental constitutional right. The right to vote is protected by more constitutional amendments, the 1st, 14th, 15th, 19th, 24th, and 26th amendments, than any other right we enjoy as Americans. A fundamental constitutional right cannot be taken away by a vote of the majority. Preventing voter fraud is certainly a compelling state interest. However, what is a minor requirement for a majority of people is a severe burden for a minority of people. Let me repeat that. What is a minor requirement for a majority of citizens is a severe burden for a minority of citizens who may be poor, elderly, or disabled and have a difficult time obtaining an identification card. If a voter ID bill were to become law, the fundamental right to vote would be defended in the courts. Lawsuits, win or lose, are going to be expensive. This is not a settled issue in Minnesota. While the Supreme Court upheld Indiana's voter ID law, Minnesota is not Indiana. First, the microscopic scrutiny of two election recounts in 2008 and 2010 have not led to a single conviction for voter impersonation fraud, which is the only type of voter fraud that photo ID requirements could possibly address. Indiana, in contrast, had a history of voter fraud. Second, Indiana does not have any federally recognized Indian tribes. Minnesota has 11. Voter ID requirements particularly affect Indian voters in two ways. First, the Minnesota Constitution guarantees the right to free exercise of religion. And along with other religions, many Indians have religious objections to identification cards bearing their photographs. Senate File 509 does not have an exemption for religious objections. Furthermore, there is a federal consent decree that protects Indian voters who register to vote with a tribal ID, which contains a picture but not address. On its face, Senate File 509 violates that consent decree. There was a time in Minnesota's history when we denied Indians the right to vote unless they could prove that they, quote, had adopted the habits and customs of civilization. And it would be shameful if we denied Indians the right to vote now. Finally, the bills currently before your committee will also have to pass muster under the Minnesota Constitution. Our Constitution contains protections greater than that provided by the United States Constitution. An oath is sufficient to ensure voter eligibility under the Minnesota Constitution. And we do not require photo ID for the exercise of other fundamental rights, like the right to religious worship, testifying before a legislative committee, or publishing a blog. Voter ID is costly, it harms a fundamental right, and there is no measure of its need or effectiveness. We respectfully urge you to oppose voter ID. I'd be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions, member? Senator Chamberlain.
I'm sorry. Said the Minnesota, you referenced the Minnesota Constitution. Doesn't the Minnesota Constitution, U.S. law somewhere also state they had to be U.S. citizens and of a certain age? How would you address that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Chamberlain, yes, the U.S. Constitution does, and the Minnesota Constitution both prescribe eligibility. But I would direct you to Article 7, Section 3 of our Constitution, which directs the legislature to provide for a uniform oath or affirmation to be administered at elections. And so they've got to be read in conjunction. You can't pick and choose provisions from the full elective franchise section of the Constitution.
Okay. Ben Hellerstein. Hellerstein. And Ben Sermon, if you can come up too, please. Welcome to the committee. If you could state your names for the tape, please.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, thank you so much for your time today. My name is Ben Hellerstein. I'm a student at Carleton College in Northfield and one of the co-chairs of our chapter of MPIRG, the Minnesota Public Interest Research Group. MPIRG is a student-directed organization at 8 colleges and universities across Minnesota that works to give students a voice in the political process. Now, I'm from the suburbs of New York originally, and when I decided to come to school at Carleton, really the main reason was I fell in love with the state of Minnesota. And I realized from the first time that I set foot here that this is a welcoming and a friendly place, and a place that invites people to get involved without putting up a lot of unnecessary barriers and obstacles. And I feel that nothing captures Minnesota's welcoming and friendly atmosphere better than its voter registration laws. You know, like I said, Minnesota invites us to get involved. It encourages us to participate, and it provides us with as many opportunities as possible to do so. Many states, it seems like the intent of their voter laws is to make it difficult for people to participate. But in Minnesota, that's not the case, and that's especially important for certain groups of voters like college students, where the quote-unquote traditional forms of identification simply don't work very well. As a result of Minnesota's great voter registration laws, this state has the highest youth voter turnout rate in the country. That's a tremendous accomplishment. It really is, and it's something that the state should be very proud of, and furthermore, that the legislature should consider very carefully before making any modifications to the process that might jeopardize that high voter turnout. On the day of the August primary election this summer, I got a call from my friend Alex. She's from California originally, but she considers herself a resident of Minnesota, and she very much wanted to vote here. She had just turned 18 the previous year, so she wasn't registered yet. Alex told me that she was about to head over to the polling place. She had heard about these great same-day registration laws, but she wasn't sure that she was going to be able to vote. The college didn't submit a resident list because, of course, classes weren't in session. She had a copy of her tuition statement, but it didn't contain her current address, and the utility bills for her home were not in her own name. The only way she was able to vote that day was because I went with her to the polling place, and I said, "Mr. Election Judge, this is my friend Alex. She is a resident of this precinct. Please allow her to vote." I vouched for her. And because of that, she was able to vote. She came out of the polling place with this huge smile on her face, and she had this, you know, little red "I voted" sticker on her shirt. She wore that sticker with more pride than I've ever seen anyone wear a sticker in the rest of my life. She felt great because she got to participate. And I felt good, too, because in some small way, I had helped her to participate. And I think that maybe that's the greatest gift we can give somebody in a democratic society, is regardless of their political views, is to help them make their voices heard. I'm concerned about the bills that are under discussion today because they will place major obstacles in the way of students who want to participate in the political process. Requiring a photo ID with your current address would be a tremendous challenge for college students who change residences at least 4 times in the span of 4 years. So under this process, they would need to get a new driver's license with their current address every single year. That would be extremely difficult for out-of-state students. Furthermore, the elimination of vouching in Senate File 509 would take away a critical option for voters when all other forms of identification fail, as they did for my friend Alex this summer. Provisional balloting is at best a partial solution, since it would require voters to take a trip to the county auditor's office, which in the case of Rice County is about 30 to 45 minutes away, not a short trip. And it requires voters to verify their identity with the same form of identification that they didn't have on election day. Ultimately, this legislation attempts to solve a problem that doesn't exist. There are simply very few confirmed cases of deliberate voter fraud in Minnesota that would be prevented under this legislation. How many instances of fraudulent voting will these bills prevent each year? A few. And yet, how many legitimate voters will be disenfranchised? Thousands, maybe tens of thousands. So my question is, why? Why make it more difficult to vote? In the absence of compelling evidence for deliberate voter fraud, why place obstacles in the way of those like my friend Alex who just want to participate in the democratic process? Why?
Well, I have a why. Maybe you could explain to me, how would we know how many people were drinking underage if we never ID'd them?
I'm sorry, I'm not sure I see the connection.
Well, we're stating here that there is no problem, that everything is fine and everyone should be able to do it, but we don't check. And so my question is, how do we know that the people voting are who they say they are? We don't require any identification. They just come in, sign up and vote, and leave. So you're stating we have no problem. This is a great friendly place. We let everyone vote. How do we know people are voting who maybe aren't supposed to be?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I think that the draw to participate in the democratic process is pretty great, but I don't know if it's so great that somebody would be motivated to vote fraudulently at risk of a felony conviction, no matter how small that risk might be. That would be what I would say to that.
Any other questions for the witness? Senator Kamen.
You claim that you made a connection. I'd like a little expansion on that. Because we have no voter ID requirement, therefore we have high voter turnout. Can you expand on that a bit? How do you make that connection?
Certainly. If the requirement was in place for students to have a in-state piece of identification with their current address on it, essentially that would add an additional burden to anybody who wished to participate in the democratic process. And anytime you're adding an additional burden, you're going to decrease the number of people who are going to participate. I would say at Carleton, this fall, we were out registering students to vote. We got over 300 students, first-time voters, to register, which is a pretty tremendous accomplishment, I think. And if it had been required of them to have an in-state ID with their current address on it, we would have gotten, I don't know, 10, maybe, 20. It's simply the type of burden it would create would ensure that only those students who are, you know, absolutely most, who can devote a huge amount of time to it would basically be able to vote.
Thank you. Mr. Serma.
Thank you. My name is Ben Serma. I am a student at Hamline University, also active at MPIRG. Our chief concern regarding Senate File 509 is the elimination of options that will be available to students who wish to register at the polls. As part of MPIRG's Democracy Task Force, I've seen just how many students choose to register on Election Day and vote. Under the bill, a student who does not have an ID with his or her current residence may present a photo ID with a current fee statement that contains a student's current precinct address. Fortunately, many fee statements do not list the student's current precinct address, but rather a parent's address. The unreliability of this option for same-day registration would lead to discouragement for many students who simply want to participate in the franchise. The only option left under Senate File 509 is to present a student ID at the polls after the school has submitted a residential housing list for both on- and off-campus dwellers. I have seen firsthand how this method works while I helped conduct voter registration last fall on campus. I can tell you it does indeed work. However, the housing list is only as accurate as the students have made it by taking time to update their contact information. As you know, students are highly transient and may move several times, even within a school year. In addition, the institutions are not required to submit such lists. Fortunately, most do. But not every institution can be relied upon to follow through each election cycle or in a special election. Though this housing list method for registration does work, it is not reliable enough to ensure that everyone who wants to register and vote on Election Day will be able to do so. By leaving only these two avenues for students to register, Senate File 509 would impose an obstacle that would discourage young people from voting. Lastly, but importantly, even if you could register using these methods, you'd still need meet an ID burden that does not allow for a student ID. So in theory, a student could get registered, only to be turned away for not having the necessary ID to actually cast their ballot. Minnesota has consistently led the nation in youth voter turnout. There's no need to jeopardize this fact, a fact we can all be proud of. The essential issue behind our concern is the message this bill sends to young people who wish to be heard and want to affect change. I know countless students who want to make a difference but feel they have no voice. Imposing hurdles such as obtaining new ID and eliminating the good options for same-day registration will not make our democracy work better, but will only serve to make our democracy less personal and more confrontational. Should we open for any more questions?
Okay, thank you. Any urgent questions? Seeing none, thank you for your testimony. Chris Bell. And after Mr. Bell will be Simone Hall. Also, the hearing we're going to have on Wednesday will be moved to room 15.
My left or my right?
So, just so you know, might be a little more comfortable.
Oh, thanks. Yes, I did hear that. Okay.
Mr. Bell, if you could state your name for the tape. And
I will do so, Mr. Chairman. Just one second.
Take your time.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. I appreciate the opportunity to testify on Senate File 509. I am the co-chair of the Minnesota Consortium for Citizens with Disabilities. And many of our concerns were addressed by the elimination of Section 20 in the A15 amendment and the amendment to the amendment. But one of the concerns we have is, frankly, fiscal. And that is that, as everyone here knows, we have a $5 billion budget deficit. And the Senate Committee on Health and Human Services has been given a $1.6 billion mark to cut in health and human services. This will affect the most vulnerable of our citizens, including people with disabilities and older people. Now, I guess it's a matter of one's priorities about where you spend money, but given the massive budget deficit and the cuts we're making to services for people with disabilities and persons who are elderly, we question whether spending, what was it, $32 million for Senate File 509 or a much smaller amount for Senate File 479 is really worth doing at this particular time, given the cuts that people are going to be receiving that desperately need the services and supports that the state hitherto has provided. One last point, I want to thank Representative Kiffmeyer for all the help she's given to me, just even right now, helping me find a seat. You know, Ryan might have found it eventually, but maybe not. But
Mr. Bell,
yes.
I don't know what happens to us if we don't do it, but you forgot to say your name when you started.
I'm sorry. You did, so I guess I assumed I didn't have to. My name is Christopher Bell.
Thank you.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. Representative Kiffmeyer mentioned addressing an issue with regarding the right of people under guardianship to vote, and she mentioned a separate bill. I would just note, Mr. Chairman, that the Minnesota Constitution currently precludes people under guardianship from voting, although by statute we have allowed it. The current section of the Constitution that states such a prohibition has been, similar language has been successfully challenged under the U.S. Constitution due process and equal protection clause and is a violation of the Americans with Disabilities Act. And I think that I hope that the committee will have an opportunity to visit any part of a bill that may be offered relating to guardianship that may affect voting rights or elections of people under guardianship because I think there are some important issues to review. And with that, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'll take any questions. Thank you.
Any questions for Mr. Bell? Seeing none, thank you for your testimony.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Simone Hall, please. Welcome to the committee. If you could state your names for the record, please.
Hello, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Simone Hall. My name is Simone Hall. My 8-year-old son and I live in supportive housing unit at People Serving People, one of the state's largest family homeless shelters. My situation is stable now, but I'm surrounded by families in crisis. I believe this photo ID bill is extremely unfair for them and thousands of Minnesotans who do not have stable housing. On election day, I vouched for several moms I know who are staying in the emergency shelter. One mom voted for the first time in years. She was extremely happy afterwards. She actually felt like a normal part of society. People lose their housing for so many reasons that are out of their control. Renters get foreclosed on, jobs lost, domestic violence, and divorce, just to name a few. But when people are homeless and they still show up to vote on election day, they are saying, I'm working to make my life better, to make my situation better. It's not easy for persons in poverty or in crisis to get state-issued IDs. There's the cost of the ID. Plus, they also have to have two forms of other IDs, like a birth certificate, which costs $26 in Minnesota. The Social Security card. When moms are fleeing abusive partners, they're thinking about their children, not about documentations of importance. They're thinking about safety. Hundreds of Minnesotans who are eligible to vote simply are too poor to afford a constant address. Low-wage workers living paycheck to paycheck are one unexpected cost away from becoming homeless. The parents who stay at People Serving People are constantly searching for stable housing. I've moved over 20 times in my life, moving homes without private transportation, money for a storage unit, and in a crisis. It's difficult to keep track of all the necessary documents. Survival instincts kick in, and only safety and basic necessities play importance. It is a blessing that Minnesota allows eligible adults to vote regardless of their housing circumstances. Minnesotans are losing their housing in the economy. They're losing their possessions, their dignity. Minnesotans in poverty should not lose the right to vote because they cannot afford a stable address. Any questions?
Okay, thank you. Seeing none, did you? Okay. Ms. Halperin, please. Good afternoon. Could you state your name for the tape?
Yes, and I hope it was the one you just read out. I have a little difficulty hearing. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I am Max Halperin, professor of computer science, representing Citizens for Election Integrity Minnesota. Article 3 of Senate File 509 contains technical requirements that do not correspond well to the author's good intentions, and if adopted, would cause serious unintended consequences. Senator Limmer and Representative Kiffmeyer have pointed to the successful Minnetonka pilot project to illustrate their intentions regarding electronic rosters. Yet the system described in this bill differs substantially from what was used in Minnetonka. In fact, the system described by the bill is of entirely unprecedented scope and complexity. The bill's language was derived from a Colorado model that operated under quite different circumstances. When that language was imported to the Minnesota context, the inadvertent result was a system different from any used in Colorado, Minnesota, or anywhere else. There are two kinds of electronic roster systems. One kind is used in jurisdictions that vote in precincts, as Minnesota does. This kind, an offline system, is what Minnetonka tested. In an offline system, each precinct operates independently. No networking extends outside the polling place. Registration data is loaded before the election, and voting data is retrieved after the election. The other kind of system is used in jurisdictions that vote in vote centers, as some Colorado, Texas, and Indiana counties do. The vote center model greatly reduces the number of polling places and allows each voter to choose any vote center in their county. The electronic rosters need to be hooked up online to a countywide system. When a voter checks in, this fact is immediately visible to all other vote centers in the county, preventing double voting. This feature is not needed where each voter is required to vote in a specific precinct. Colorado's law that served as the model for SF-509 applied only to counties using vote centers. Although vote centers required online rosters, they also made such rosters feasible by greatly reducing polling places. Denver, the largest county, used only 55 vote centers in its ill-fated 2006 election. By contrast, Hennepin County has 425 precincts, approximately half of them in the large cities that the A15 amendment covers. Worse yet, SF-509 calls for immediate statewide, not merely countywide, visibility of any voting activity. No state has ever set up a statewide online roster system reaching individual precincts. One consequence is needless expense, but an even greater concern is the risk of Election Day chaos. There is no better recipe for technology adoption to go wrong than inappropriate requirements that demand needless complexity and interconnection of components. I urge you to delete this article. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Senator Kalish.
Mr. Chair, on the technology of this is, because one of my concerns is to make sure it's available across the state, make sure that the Hennepin County and St. Paul or St. Cloud aren't the only ones that are required to use this. Is there a possibility of going to this kind of system where we've got online information being checked throughout the state? Systems that would handle that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Kalish, I would consider a system that attempted to tie together 3,000 or 4,000 precincts statewide, as the original bill as introduced covered, to be even less advisable than the A15, which would only reach hundreds of precincts, in the sense that the risk of a system failure having serious consequences increases the greater the scope of the system. There really is no need, even if you want to have electronic poll books in every precinct, that they be online electronic poll books in every precinct, as both the original bill and the A15 covers. I frankly don't know, aside from the use of the Colorado model, why it is that the bill specifies that. The authors would be presumably better qualified to answer that.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As a member of this committee, I'd just like the record show that, despite what Mr. Halperin said, I have made no comparison or mention of the Minnetonka system for how they account for balloting. And even though that's what Mr. Halperin alleged that I said, I did not.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, just to follow up.
Senator Kalish.
Yeah, one of the things that I'm concerned about is what happens if these crash, and I've had enough computer crashes and heard of enough malfunctions in all of these systems. The bigger you make them, the easier it is for them to crash. What's our alternatives, or can we have a fail-safe kind of system in place to back up anything that's been done administratively or electronically?
Mr. Halperin.
Mr. Chair, Senator Kalish, first let me take the opportunity to apologize to Senator Limmer that I certainly hope I don't give offense. It was not my intention to do so. I was referring to the press conference that Senator Limmer and Representative Kiffmeyer held when they introduced the bill. And at that press conference, the Minnetonka pilot project was brought up as an example of what was intended here. The press release that came out of that press conference is on the legislature's website, and an examination of it could probably answer the question whether it was Representative Kiffmeyer who made the specific mention of Minnetonka or Senator Limmer who did so. If it was not Senator Limmer, I certainly would apologize. To Senator Kalish's question, and thank you for your patience. The bill does call for contingency planning. It specifies that paper rosters can be used as a contingency plan, which, of course, cuts into some of the intended cost savings, or that computer systems that operate without needing network access and without needing AC power for a period of at least a couple hours could be used as the contingency plan. I will say that any kind of contingency planning poses considerable challenges in terms of things like knowing when, as an election judge, to give up on trying to troubleshoot Plan A and switch to Plan B. That's what, you know, those of us who were present at the House hearing that parallels this one observed with regard to the video that we saw today. On that occasion, the problem wasn't that the technology failed and the video didn't roll the first time. The problem is that there was this extended period of, okay, we're going to leave that till the next meeting, let's move on. Oh, no, we almost have it working. Oh, no, let's leave it till next. Oh, we almost have it working. And you know, I think that if that's happening at 7 a.m. on election day, when people are kind of in a hurry to get to work, you know, you could see a situation like what happened in Denver in 2006. On that occasion, they did have contingency plans. Those contingency plans were never put into place, and an estimated 18 to 20,000 would-be voters left without voting.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Deborah Mangan.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Stevens.
While she's coming up, I just wanted to ask about the, what are you going to do since we're out of time, or what's your intention for the rest of the committee?
I think we're trying to get everyone from out of town, hopefully, but by 3, and then we're going to adjourn until Wednesday. Is that Ms. Mangan?
Good afternoon, Senator. Mr. Chairperson. My name is Deborah Mangan. I'm the city clerk from the city of Edina, and I'm also a co-chair of the League of Minnesota Cities Elections Task Force and the MCFOA Elections Advisory Task Force. I thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today. Cities basically have two major concerns that I would like to address today. The first concern is to make sure that the effective date of any legislation is not until 2012. If the effective date were to become August 1st of 2011, we have many school districts and cities that have an August 9th primary and a November 8th general election. So we respectfully request that you make sure any effective date happens with the 2012 election cycle and not the 2011 election cycle. The second area of concern that we have deals with the provisional ballots. The provisional ballots process adds another category of ballots to a system that now has both election day ballots and absentee ballots and their subsequent processes. More complexity increases the probability of errors by voters, election judges, and election administrators. The provisional ballot process has high costs and complexity. Additional supplies would include ballot boxes, transfer cases, seals, envelopes, and forms to ensure that everything is handled properly. In addition, we would need to have
place two additional election judges from both parties in the precinct to supervise the provisional path to make sure that voters get those ballots into the correct ballot box. This would also entail additional retraining of those election judges. After election data entry, we would have to secure provisional ballots, have voters come in to validate their ballots, would require additional staff time and in process, perhaps have offices open during hours that they're not typically open. We would also have to bring in our ballot boards to count the provisional ballots after the election. We must also deal with the possibility that when adding provisional ballot totals to election day totals, errors may occur. Eliminating the provisional ballot requirement of the bill is feasible while still maintaining the photo ID requirement by using the affidavit in the polling place instead of after the election at the clerk or auditor's office. That would reduce the cost and avoid the complexity of that additional provisional ballot procedure. Thank you. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Any questions for Ms. Mangan? Senator Stevens.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Mangan, do you have any idea how much additional money implementing either of these bills would cost just your jurisdiction, just Edina?
Thank you, Senator Seaman and Chairperson. I really don't have any rough numbers. I did try to do some. We train your ballot costs. I think we figured it would be in the neighborhood of maybe $10,000. And we've already adopted budgets. You know, we're trying to keep things as lean as we can. That would be if we were to do the one that was the 479. If we were to have to introduce the electronic roster, the cost would be much greater because, as I understand it, the electronic rosters handle approximately 500 voters per roster, but I don't have a good handle on the technical aspect of that. I do have concerns of the capital outlay for additional machines over and above what would be provided.
Thank you.
Okay, Senator Kalish.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Mangan, one of the questions I have that you brought up was finding extra election judges, and that, could you just give us your view on how difficult it is to find election judges for all the precincts, not just in the metro area, but in outstate Minnesota, if you have any of that information?
Thank you, Chair, Senator Kalish. I'm really blessed in Edina with really great volunteers, but I do know that some of my co-election administrators in outlying areas do have a difficult time maintaining a full complement of judges throughout the day. If we have to add and keep party balance in some of the outlying areas, that will be difficult.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Again, we're planning to meet in room 15 on Wednesday. If you plan to attend, and
Senator Vandeveer,
yes, sir.
You mentioned out-of-state travelers. You get a chance to speak. I'm from Rochester. On your list, would I have an opportunity?
Well, let's. If members are able, I just apparently.
I guess that didn't include.
There's another committee.
Sorry. She's got another committee. You're welcome to come up. We'll listen, and if it's all right with Senator Kalish, I know.
It's fine. Whatever.
I'll come back once again.
Well, thank you. All right. With that, members, we are adjourned.